Lecture 21, The Origins of Japanese Buddhism.
In our last lecture, we talked about some of the varieties of Chinese Buddhism that developed during the Tang Dynasty, really the classical period of the development of Chinese Buddhism. Obviously, there was a lot more that happened in China after the end of the Tang Dynasty. Buddhism didn't stop developing in China at that point. Many centuries ago, there were lots of things that happened in the relationship between Buddhism and Confucianism, and also the development and expansion of different Chinese schools. But I think you have a sense from what we've talked about already of at least some of the major varieties of Chinese Buddhism, and also some of the ways that the Chinese tradition changed Buddhism quite radically from the tradition that they first received from India. So you could go to China now, knowing what we've talked about, and have a pretty good sense of what you'd see, be able to interpret the kinds of Buddhism that are readily available to you in the temples and in the major pilgrimage sites in China today. So it's time for us now to move on to another phase in the development of East Asian Buddhism, to the Buddhism of Japan, a tradition that also was rich, creative, did some remarkable things with the Buddhist values that it received from China and more indirectly from India, and also has had a lot of effect on the kind of Buddhism that we experience today in America and in the rest of the world. Now, Buddhism entered Japan as early as the year 535 from Korea, which is one of the closest places where the Japanese have been able to get access to traditional Chinese values. And it came at a time when the Japanese were suffering some of the same difficulties that the Chinese had experienced a few centuries earlier in the decline of the Han Dynasty. Both Korea and China in this period had recently been unified politically, and they had, before that time, gone through a period of considerable political disruption. While Japan itself was still in a state of feudal warfare, there were still clans that were battling each other. In fact, some of the great stories about Japanese military heroism actually come from that time before the 6th century, as people battled back and forth across the landscape in Japan. There was a sense, especially among people who looked across the sea to Korea and to China, that the Japanese needed a new strategy, really, and a new system of values to organize the affairs of the nation so that they could really keep up with what was going on in Korea and China. And to find an effective model for this, the Japanese looked to China, the source of many important cultural traditions in Japan. In China, they found Buddhism, of course. It had flourished in the Tang Dynasty and were now really at the end of the period of the Tang Dynasty. And they also saw in the Chinese imperial tradition a revived form of Confucianism. They used both these two traditions, Confucianism and also Buddhism, to help reorganize and refocus the energies of the Japanese state. And this meant that the process of adaptation in Japan took a very different turn than it took in China. When the first Buddhist monks, we've talked about, slipped down across the trade routes in Central Asia and entered northern China at the end of the 2nd century of the Common Era, they found that the old Confucian synthesis was really in disgrace. It had fallen apart, essentially. The emperor, who had functioned as the center of the Confucian ethical system, had lost control of the country, and he no longer commanded respect. When Buddhist monks from India looked for a vocabulary to express their Buddhist values in a Chinese way, they naturally formed an alliance with Taoism. Talked about this. This is something that transformed the character of a Buddhist teaching in China in quite a distinctive way. Now, the idioms of these two traditions were actually quite different, of course. The Chinese flavor of Taoism was quite different from the abstractions of the Buddhist tradition in India. But it was not a major leap for a Taoist intellectual to think that Buddhism offered the same culture of withdrawal and detachment from the concerns of the world, even the same culture of non-being, because emptiness was a value that was important for Buddhists, and non-being an important way of expressing Taoist understandings of the Tao, so that a Taoist intellectual could easily move back and forth between the tradition of Taoism and the tradition of Buddhism. In Japan, the big issues, the big intellectual issues, were really different than they were in China. The Japanese wanted to know how Buddhism could strengthen the power of the emperor and unify the Japanese state. And they wanted to know how Buddhism could make peace, not with a group of Taoist intellectuals or Taoist contemplative sages. They wanted to know how Buddhism could somehow be harmonized with an indigenous religious tradition that in lots of ways was distinctively Japanese. And this indigenous tradition is what we know today as Shinto, or the way of the gods, in contrast to Buddhism, which is the way of the Buddha. Now, you can understand Shinto, I think, as the indigenous nature and spirit worship of Japan. That's a nice formula that you can use to begin to grasp what it is that Shinto is concerned with. It's a tradition that's often associated with sacred places in the Japanese landscape, especially a place like Mount Fuji, which is such an extraordinarily dominant feature in the Japanese landscape just south of Tokyo. It also is associated with powerful natural forces like the sun, the earth, the movement of the seasons, and the wind. But the list of possible deities in Shinto includes not just the forces of nature, but anything that has superior power, including the ancestors and the emperor. So you might say that the sacred in the Shinto tradition can be manifested in all sorts of different ways and felt in lots of different ways. The deities of Shinto are known in Japanese as kami, K-A-M-I, kami. This is a word that we know already in English in the term kamikaze, or divine wind. That was an important storm, or a large storm, that played an important role in Japanese history when it once blew away the Mongol invasion fleet that was threatening Japan, and it was, of course, reappropriated and used during the Second World War to talk about a certain kind of suicide pilot who was enlisted to attempt to drive away the threat of an American invasion fleet that was threatening Japan. So the kamikaze is the divine wind, or the wind of the kami. Now, to understand the way a sophisticated practitioner of Shinto would understand the kami, I'd like to read a short passage from the work of a man named Motori Norinaga, who was a well-known 18th century interpreter of Shinto. In some respects, quite a modern figure, contemporary, probably, of Thomas Jefferson. "I do not yet understand the meaning of the term kami," he said. "Speaking in general, however, it may be said that kami signifies, in the first place, the deities of heaven and earth that appear in the ancient records and also the spirits of the shrines where they are worshipped. It's hardly necessary to say that it also includes human beings. It includes such objects as birds, beasts, trees, plants, oceans, mountains, and so forth. In ancient usage, anything whatsoever which was outside the ordinary, which possessed superior power, or which was awe-inspiring, was called kami. Eminence here does not refer merely to the superiority of nobility, goodness, or meritorious deeds." In other words, the kamis aren't always nice to you. They're not always friendly forces. "Evil and mysterious things, if they are extraordinary and dreadful, are called kami. It's needless to say that among human beings who are called kami, the generations of sacred emperors are all included." Got a glimpse, actually, of the two sides of the nature of the kami when I was in Japan just this summer. I visited the Tokyo National Museum just to see what was up, and also since Tokyo is extraordinarily hot in the month of July, to find a nice, cool stone building where I could just hang out for a couple of hours and catch my breath. There was a very beautiful display of art that was connected to a figure named Tenjin, who was a scholar. The story of Tenjin was that he was a scholar at a particular period in Japanese history, and he ran afoul of the authorities in the court, and he was driven out of the capital, persecuted, and eventually took his own life. So he was in some ways, I suppose, the embodiment of restraint and scholarly virtues, virtues which I would, on a good day, attempt to embody myself, I suppose. Anyway, after his death, people began to experience hauntings and natural disasters, terrifying events that they began to associate with him. And they established a cult of his presence and began to worship him, and also developed quite a remarkable tradition of artistic representation of him, both as a scholar and also as a terrifying figure who rode on the thunderstorms and caused all sorts of destructive events in Japanese life. And even in his scholarly form, there's a little look in his eye that just seems slightly wild, that looks like it's about to burst forth into some kind of angry manifestation of his power. So the kami in Japanese culture have this split character. They obviously can be quite benign and quite protective when approached in a certain way, but they also have the ability to be quite destructive. Now, the most important kami in the Japanese tradition is the sun goddess, Amaterasu. The rising sun, of course, is the symbol of Japan, and the power of the sun goddess is understood as being present and embodied in the lineage of the emperors. If you want to get a visceral sense of the Japanese feeling for the rising sun, you might imagine, this is an imaginative experiment that would be pretty easy to do, you could imagine that you were making the pilgrimage to the top of Mount Fuji in the summertime when the snow fields recede enough to clear a path to the top. The way you normally do this pilgrimage is to walk up to one of the high mountain huts on the afternoon before the day when you plan to reach the top, and you spend the night in a hut, wake up at 4 a.m, and go outside to greet the rising sun as it comes up out of the Pacific and begins to cast its light on Mount Fuji. It's an awesome experience. And in the technical sense almost that we talk about awe in religious studies, it's not just a benign experience. It simply overwhelms you. It's mysterious, it's powerful, and it makes you feel extremely small, and also expresses in a sense that sense of power and energy that the Japanese associate not just with the sun, but also with the nation of Japan. Now, the presence of Shinto posed a challenge to Buddhism. In Japan, were the Shinto and Buddhist deities rivals, or were they in some way manifestations of the same power? When Buddhism first entered Japan, some Japanese saw Buddhism as a threat, but eventually the two traditions were perceived as complementary, so that the kami and the Buddhas could be worshipped together. This is a distinctive feature of Japanese religious life, that the kami and the Buddhas are often perceived as being different faces or different manifestations of the same powerful supernatural energy. To understand how that happened, we have to take a closer look at the actual historical process that made Buddhism such an integral part of Japanese life. This story begins with a figure by the name of Prince Shotoku, who lived from 573 to 621, and who developed for Japan a 17-article constitution that provided a combination of Buddhist and Confucian values to serve as a charter for the reorganization of Japanese political life. He changed the ranks in the court to conform to a Chinese model. He reformed the principles of etiquette, You can see Confucian values at work here. He adopted a Chinese calendar so that you would perform the proper rituals at just the right time during the flow of the seasons. He built highways to tie the empire together so that they could communicate easily with the outlying provinces. And he established a system of government chronicles to keep accurate records. And he also, in addition to all of these projects that are essentially Confucian projects, he went on a building campaign to promote the worship of the Buddha. Most of his reforms grew out of Confucian values. These were values that the Chinese themselves always seemed to rediscover whenever a new dynasty tried to draw China together into a unified empire. But Shotoku was also a convinced and devout Buddhist, and he felt that Buddhism could be used to unify the nation and promote the welfare of the Japanese people. Shotoku expressed his new values in a manifesto called the 17 Article Constitution. I'll read just short pieces from the first two articles to give you a sense of the way he expressed himself and promoted a new vision of Japanese political life. The first article shows the influence of Confucianism. Harmony is to be valued, and avoidance of wanton opposition is to be honored. All men are influenced by partisanship, and there are few who are intelligent. Hence, there are some who disobey their lords and fathers or who maintain feuds with the neighboring villages. But when those above are harmonious and those below are friendly, and there is concord in the discussion of business, right views of things spontaneously gain acceptance, then what is there which cannot be accomplished? You know, if you come to this for the first time, it almost seems like a list of platitudes. You sort of say, oh, ho-hum, that sounds like pretty basic stuff. I can sign on to that. But what you have to see here is that behind this lies the whole weight of the Confucian organization of political life and also the Confucian vision of a harmonious, structured, and hierarchical society. So with these words, he was importing something much larger than the mere sense of a harmonious society and a sense of respect for your neighbor. The second article shows his concern for Buddhism. Sincerely reverence the three treasures. These three treasures, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, are the final refuge of the four generated beings and are the supreme objects of faith in all countries, or at least in all countries that were important to Prince Shotoku at that period. Few men are utterly bad, he says. They may be taught to follow it, but if they do not betake to the three treasures, wherewithal shall their crookedness be made straight? A nice image of the Buddhist path. You can hear, of course, in these words, the echoes of Ashoka, the great Dharma Raja, the righteous king who protects and defends the Dharma and also uses the Dharma as imperial policy. Now, this policy of supporting and taking legitimacy from the Buddhist tradition really flourished in the next period of Japanese history that's called the Nara period. It extended from the year 710 to 784, and it's named after the city that served as its capital, the city of Nara. It's a great place to visit, actually, if you go and explore Japanese Buddhism today. Less than a century after the death of Shotoku, Buddhism effectively became a state religion, as it was established in Nara. The Emperor Shomu, who reigned from 724 to 749, sponsored a series of building projects that gave special prominence to Buddhism as an instrument of national policy. He built a temple called Todaiji, the Great Eastern Temple, that was a symbol for him of the relationship between Buddhism and the Japanese state. This temple you can still visit, and it's said to be the largest wooden building in the world. It's a pretty impressive place, actually, and one that's well worth marking down on the list of tourist sites to stop in when you're next zipping through Japan. This temple houses a colossal bronze statue of the Buddha known as Dainichi in Japan, or the Great Illumination. This is the Japanese version of Vairochana, the old Indian Buddha of illumination, the Buddha of the sun. And you can see why the Japanese would find a natural connection between this Buddha from the Indian pantheon and their own indigenous religious interests. According to tradition, the emperor sent messengers, when he was planning to build this shrine, out to the shrine of Amaterasu in Ise to seek her permission to erect the statue of Vairochana. And the message that came back said that the sun Buddha was the Buddhist counterpart of the sun goddess. And this is the beginning of this attempt to map Buddhism onto the indigenous religious beliefs of Japan. John Rosenfield, a professor of Buddhist art at Harvard, has said that the Great Eastern Temple is like Westminster Abbey in England in the way it expresses the spiritual values of the nation. Really serves in lots of ways as a religious symbol of national identity and national pride. But the Buddhism of the Nara period was not just an expression of imperial policy. The Nara emperors also sponsored serious monastic practice and attempted to introduce some of the philosophical traditions that were then common in China. There's no need to go into them in a lot of detail, but they're probably worth mentioning. One was the so-called Sanron school, or three treatise school, associated with Nagarjuna. Another was Hosso, the Japanese version of the Yogacara tradition that also came from China and was popular in a certain period. And then a Japanese version of the Huayan or flower garland school that's known as Qigong. In this tradition, there is an image of Vairochana Buddha as subsuming the entire universe. It's that image that was represented in the Vairochana Buddha of the great shrine in Nara. Now, at the end of the Nara period, the capital was moved to Kyoto, a city that was just really a few miles away and very easy to visit when you're in Nara or vice versa. And Japan entered another period known as the Heian period, which lasted from 794 to 1185 and was a period of remarkable peace, prosperity, and courtly sophistication. So it represents, in many respects, the most civilized and sophisticated time in the history of Japanese culture and Japanese life. Now, in this period, there were two important Buddhist schools that emerged in Kyoto that had tremendous effect on the later development of Japanese religious life. One of these was the Shingon school, or the True Word School, founded by a figure known as Kukai, or Kobo Daishi, who lived from 774 to 835. Kukai traveled to China to find an authentic form of Buddhist practice, as was common in that time. If you were fed up with the monks who you were hanging out with in Nara, if they seemed to be fighting a little too much over their influence in the court or some other mundane issues, and you really wanted to find an authoritative new form of Buddhism that you could use to reform that tradition and give you some leverage on it, one of the best ways to do it was to split for China and just go see what was popular in China, what was active, what was most being practiced, and learn it, bring it back to Japan. So Kukai went to China, visited in the capital, and found, this is an interesting historical accident, actually, he found that there was a form of Chinese tantra known as Chen Yin, or the mantra school, the mantrayana, that was particularly popular for a short period of time in China just at that moment. He studied that tradition and brought it back to Japan and promulgated it under the name of Shingon. So Shingon is the Japanese version of a Chinese word that was used to translate the word mantrayana, one of the important words that we've used to refer to Indian tantra. Kukai founded a monastery on Mount Koya, not in Kyoto, but some miles distant, that still serves as the administrative and religious center of the Shingon school. And it's a place, too, that should go on your list of possible sites to visit in Japan. You know that Tantra, as we've discussed it over the last few lectures, is a tradition that puts special emphasis on power and seems often to have a very mysterious aura associated especially with the practice of some of the great saints. When you go to Mount Koya, it's not too far away from the centers of population in Japan, but you go up a long tramway that really seems to take you almost into another world. And at the top of the mountain, there's a graveyard that I would have to say, it's just between you and me, is one of the spookiest places in all of Japan. It's in a grove of enormous cypress trees, and it's very dark, covered with moss. And you walk down a long pathway through this dark forest surrounded by graves. Often, if you go there in the afternoon, there are people coming in for memorial services or bringing the remnants of somebody's cremation carefully wrapped in an urn in solemn processions down through this dark forest to be implanted in one of these graves. And at the end of the pathway is a cave where they say that Kukai sits in meditation and is waiting to come out. You really can, in some funny way, I think, feel the presence of Kukai in that place, and it speaks with the aura of power and mystery that we associate with Tantra. The elaborate esoteric rituals of the Shingon, especially the great mandalas that Kukai brought back from China, as part of his practice, had immense appeal in the Heian court and give us quite a remarkable impression, actually, of how tantric practice can be woven in to courtly life in a sophisticated and urbane center of civilization like Kyoto in the Heian period. Now, another important religious figure in Japan in this time was Saicho, or Dengyo Daishi, who lived from 762 to 822 and founded a school known as Tendai, another extremely influential school in Japanese religious history. Tendai is the Japanese version of the Chinese Tiantai school. It was founded in China, as you remember, by Zhe. Like Zhe, Saicho stressed the importance of the Lotus Sutra. You remember that Zhe used the Lotus Sutra to interpret and rank the other teachings in the Mahayana. And Saicho used the teaching of one vehicle as a unifying principle, not just to unify Buddhist teaching, but also, and this specific Japanese spin that many of these figures put on the Buddhist tradition when it entered Japan. He used it as a unifying principle, not just intellectually or religiously, but as a principle that unified the Japanese nation and could serve as the ideological justification for the emperor's extension of his power over all of Japan. This is evident in a text he wrote called The Vow of Uninterrupted Study of the Lotus Sutra. The disciple of the Buddha, he says, and the student of the one vehicle, this day respectfully affirms before the three treasures that the saintly emperor, on behalf of Japan and as a manifestation of his unconditional compassion, established the Lotus sect and had the Lotus Sutra, its commentary, and the essays on concentration and insight that had been written by Zhe, copied and bound, together with hundreds of other volumes, and installed them in seven great temples. Constantly did he promote the single and only vehicle, and he united all the people so that they might ride together in the ox cart of the Mahayana to the ultimate destination, enlightenment. And this is interesting for us. This has been one of the funny sub-themes, actually, that's run throughout our course. We think of Buddhism as a tradition that we might, I suppose, call spiritual. It has to do with inner transformation and, to some degree, withdrawal from the world. And yet we have seen again and again and again the way Buddhist values become enmeshed in the issues of political life. Here, Saicho is taking the Lotus Sutra, a text that we've really only discussed in a religious form previously, and giving a distinctive Japanese political spin on it, where the one vehicle is not just the Mahayana, not just the Bodhisattva practice, but it is, as it were, a metaphor for the Japanese state that the emperor drives like a cart carrying the whole nation with him to achieve the goal of nirvana. Very strong image, and clearly has a very different flavor than anything that we've seen before. Now, the Tendai school included many different varieties of Buddhist practice and had a rigor in its practice that was not seen before previously in Japan, and became eventually the spawning ground of many of the great schools in later Japanese history. So Saicho had influence not just on his time, but also on the movements that eventually emerged that changed the face of Japanese Buddhism in later periods, particularly in the Kamakura. And it's the Kamakura period, of course, that we want to turn to next in our next lecture.